Thanks for joining us. I'm Frank Sesno, host of Planet Forward and director of the School of Media and Public Affairs at the George Washington University. I'm sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's been on vacation, but she'll be back with you tomorrow. In the animal kingdom, ants, bees, termites, birds, and fish are some of the creatures that have evolved in some remarkable ways to solve problems by working as groups. A new book describes how human scientists, business leaders, and engineers are studying the collective intelligence exhibited by animals to learn how people can become better at communicating, making decisions, and getting things done. The author is Peter Miller, a National Geographic senior editor. His book is entitled Smart Swarm. He joins us in the studio. I should say, Peter, that the book is actually entitled The Smart Swarm, How Understanding Flocks, Schools, and Colonies Can Make Us Better at Communicating, Decision-Making, and Getting Things Done. Where'd you come up with this idea?
Oh, thanks. You know that natural groups are full of intelligent behavior, and lately there's been a lot of interest in getting to the bottom of exactly how groups like flocks and schools and ant colonies manage to deal with an unpredictable environment, how they deal with complexity and how they deal with change. And these are all things that we're facing in our organizations more and more and more.
So you think we can actually, and you've concluded that we can and are actually learning from these bugs and bees around us?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, you know, nature is full of intelligence, but you just don't always take the time to notice it. If you look at an ant colony, what you see is a model of self-organization. You see that they have a bottom-up system that allows behavior of individuals with limited computational abilities. I mean, ants are not that bright. To solve
despite the great movies.
Yeah. Despite all the movies, it allows them to translate that simple individual behavior into group behavior that is, you could describe as a strategy, as a problem-solving ability, as a survival technique.
Now, you were telling me just before we went on the air that you were actually talking about all of this at a place where our taxpayer dollars are at work just yesterday.
Yes, I was invited to speak at the Treasury Department yesterday, and it was a wonderful opportunity to talk to people who are managers and executives, and they had lots of great questions about, well, does this mean that, you know, we need to be tapping into the collective intelligence in our staff, you know, and things like that.
So you were actually talking to them about ants and bees?
Ants and bees. That was the main topic of conversation.
Tell me what a smart swarm is.
A smart swarm is a group, and it might be a large group like an ant colony that may have millions of members, or a school of fish like those beautiful ones you see swimming in the Caribbean nature films. Or it might be a small group like a committee, church, or a task force, or a jury. But the function of the group is to make the individuals in the group smarter than they could be by themselves, more able to deal with problems, make better decisions, make them healthier, make them safer. So there's a benefit to individuals to being part of a smart swarm.
So are you saying that, for example, when we see a huge ant colony, whether it's off on the trail someplace in the woods or under my porch, that there's something smart about that collective activity?
Absolutely. If you see...
It's deliberate?
If you see, you know, like a trail of ants going across your front porch, you notice that they stop and they touch antennas. Everyone checks in with the other one. What they're doing is communicating through chemical interaction. They can tell from the smell whether the individual that they're meeting is part of their own group. And if they're not, then there's going to be a fight. They can tell if they're a worker of their work class. They might be a forager. They might be a maintenance worker. Foragers smell different than maintenance workers because foragers work outside. Maintenance workers work inside. So all this information is being transferred from one ant to another, even though the ants themselves are not that bright. So when you have all this flow of information going back and forth through 10,000 simple individuals, what emerges is a pattern of behavior that is good for the colony. And that gets at a very central idea in this whole book, which is that the colony is the important thing. Ants are not smart. Ant colonies are smart. Ants don't reproduce. Ant colonies reproduce. So natural selection is really operating at the level of the colony, and the colonies are the ones that we need to look to for as models of smart behavior.
Peter Miller is author of The Smart Swarm, How Understanding Flocks, Schools, and Colonies Can Make Us Better at Communicating, Decision-Making, and Getting Things Done. We'll take your questions and comments about ant colonies or beehives or how we apply them in our real lives at 1-800-433-8850. You can email us at drshow@wamu.org. But in fact, in your book, Peter, you repeatedly and early on make the link between ants and bees and termites and humans and how we've already sought to study their behaviors and incorporate them. The one that I think most people will, or certainly a lot of people will, relate to right away is how Southwest Airlines modeled their seating system, their very unusual seating system, on the behavior of ants.
Well, yeah, sure. Southwest Airlines is kind of a maverick. They're the only airlines that I know of, in the U.S. at least, that still allow you to pick your own seat when you get on the plane. Everybody else makes, you know, you take an assigned seat. But a few years ago, they were getting inquiries from their business travelers, you know, well, why do I have to wait in line? You know, I'd rather, you know, I'm a regular customer. I don't want to have to get to the airport early. So they said, okay, let's figure out what would be the impact on our business if we did go to a reservation, you know, seat assignment. So they asked an analyst on their staff to do this, and he thought about it a little bit. He worked it over in his mind, and he thought, you know, what do we have here? We have individuals that are trying to cram into a tight space and do something that's smart for each one of them. He says, that's a biological problem. That's what ants do.
He came up with this himself?
He came up with this idea himself. So what he did was he borrowed some techniques from computer simulation in which he created what you might call virtual ants. And these were little programs that acted like as if the ants were actually going on the plane. And he sent them on the plane, you know, through the galley, and they would get into the 737, and they would say, oh, there's a seat over there that I would like to be to. So they would try to get to that seat, but if they're being blocked by someone who's like stowing their luggage or getting, you know, trying to wait for their seat, then they would have to wait. And that would all add up to the amount of time that it takes to load the plane. So he did this over and over again using this simulation, this sort of like an ant simulation. And what he discovered was that you could save a few minutes if you boarded in a certain way using reservations. But it was only a few minutes. And the decision was made at the top that it was more important to maintain the business model that they already had than to switch over. But he said, you know, this was an opportunity to apply the wisdom that the ants show to a very practical.
What do we learn from the ants? How did that modeling, when they used ants to model how you were going to scramble to your seat on a Southwest flight, change from the way you would have modeled it or what you would have learned if you were just studying human behavior without the benefit of the ant colony?
Well, it's what he was using, in fact, was a model system we call agent-based modeling. And the agents are what he called moving cognitive objects. So, in fact, they reminded him of ants, but he wasn't actually using the kind of biological responses that ants would use. He was using the sort of physical resemblance of agent-based models to little ants.
So what do we actually learn from the ants? What did Southwest Airlines actually learn from the ants?
Well, what they learned from the computer simulation,
right,
was that if you try out all the different possible combinations, if you let individuals like little ants board the plane in every possible way under realistic circumstances, you know, which is something that's too expensive to do in person, you know, with a live crew, say. I mean, you could do it that way. You could hire people to do it, you know, for months and months and months. Then the potential savings was not great enough. So they went to a different system, which essentially is lining up. You can reserve a place in line. You can still pick your seat.
I'm not sure.
Keep everybody happy.
I'm not sure whether I'm more inspired by the fact that Southwest used ants to model it, or I'm used, you know, like a cattle on other airlines. But we learned from the animal kingdom. You write this. We call an ant colony self-organizing because nobody's in charge, nobody knows what needs to be done, and nobody tells anybody else what to do. You go on, although the ultimate origins of self-organization remain something of a mystery. Researchers have identified three basic mechanisms by which it works. decentralized control, distributed problem solving, and multiple interactions. Those three things. Talk about that a little bit.
First of all, let's establish that everybody in an ant colony is a female. All the workers are females. In fact, they're all sisters. So they are all descended from one queen. The queen, however, has no authority. She is just the egg-laying machine. All of the authority, all of the decision-making ability resides in those thousands and thousands of little ants who are responding to things they bump into, other ants they bump into, in a very simple way. So the mysterious part, the self-organizing part, is that the behavior that the colony needs to make decisions every day. For example, what are the problems that an ant colony faces? Where are we going to find food today? What kind of food are we going to need? Are the neighbors going to attack us? What's the weather like today? Do we need to keep more of our workers at home to take care of the brood? Do we need to assign more workers to go look for seeds in the desert? Do we need, was there a windstorm last night that damaged the nest? Do we need, so ordinarily we would think, okay, well, let's do this in an organized way. We need managers. We need somebody to say, okay, let's send an extra 50 ants out there to get that food because we're running low. I'm getting reports from the warehouse that we're running low. Not how it works at all in an ant colony. Ant colony is self-regulated. And I won't call it automatic because it's more beautiful than that.
We're talking with Peter Miller, The Smart Swarm, how understanding flocks, schools, and colonies can make us better at communicating, decision-making, and getting things done. Take a short break. When we come back, you're going to find out how the CIA learned from termites. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane today. Diane will be back with you tomorrow. We're talking to Peter Miller. He is author of the new book, The Smart Swarm, How Understanding Flocks, Schools, and Colonies Can Make Us Better at Communicating, Decision-Making, and Getting Things Done. Termites and the CIA.
Okay, here's the link there. Termites are probably the most ingenious architects in the animal kingdom. They construct an elaborate place to live, which is called a mound, and it contains an air conditioning system, you could say. It has an elaborate duct system that vents warm air from the basement into the tiny holes in the sides. It's the most complex structure you can imagine, and yet none of the individual termites has any idea how to do that. There are no architects. There are no blueprints. It's all done through this interaction, simple behavior. What they have done, in essence, is create the equivalent of say, Wikipedia for us, in which individuals contribute their little mud ball to the fund of knowledge in this online encyclopedia, and other people then add their little mud ball, and pretty soon you have a mound of information that is proven to be quite useful.
Termite crowdsourcing,
exactly what's happening. So a few years ago, some agents in the intelligence community were kind of alarmed by the degree to which the silo of information were keeping analysts from talking to one another. And they said, well, why don't we use some of these collaborative techniques that we see in nature to establish a platform where we can talk to one another on a very early basis, not after everything's all polished and this is our official report, but when the information's still coming in. So they set up all kinds of what you'd call Web 2.0 tools, and all of the agencies were able to access this.
But you're not telling me that they actually went and studied a termite mound and said, let's take the termite mound architecture and apply it to our challenges here at the CIA, are you?
The inspiration was biological. The original idea for it came from an analyst who said nature works in a collaborative way. And what they created was something called Intellipedia, which is the intelligence version of Wikipedia. And in the book, I talk about the incident in New York where a plane hit an apartment building. It was later discovered that it was a pilot. The pilot was a New York Yankee pitcher. But for a few hours, it was very alarming.
Right. People worried about
terrorism.
People
were worried. It had only been a few years since 9/11. And this was really an interesting example where Intellipedia started to fill up with information from different sources, from 80 different analysts, in a very new way. It was not anything official. Nobody told them to do it. It was spontaneous. But it indicated, how intelligence could be collected on a collaborative way rather than keeping everything secret.
We're already getting calls and questions via email for our guest, Peter Miller, the author of The Smart Swarm, How Understanding Flocks, Schools, and Colonies Can Make Us Better at Communicating, Decision-Making, and Getting Things Done. If you want to join us, you can by emailing us, if you choose to do that, at drshow@wamu.org. You can call us at 1-800-433-8850. I want to go first to an email that we got here for you. This is from Virginia. From a listener who writes, interesting show. I'm afraid, however, the author is confusing real intelligence from what we perceive or want to perceive as intelligence. Animals evolve these behaviors because the individuals who performed these behaviors generations ago survived better. They did not come to these behaviors based on reasoning and logic. She continues, we have to be careful of attributing intelligence and reasoning to situations where it's not really happening.
Well, that's a great question, and what the emailer is pointing out is how different nature works than the way we work. We think we have a problem. Let's come up with a plan. Let's break it down into different things that we can do. Let's approach it. Let's measure the outcome. That's not how nature works at all. Nature's messy, and it works in distributed, decentralized ways. We are after reliability, efficiency, and discipline.
And individual logic.
Research, and control.
Research.
And, exactly.
Adding information.
We want to know. We want to keep everything under control and rationality, exactly. Natural groups like ants and bees and fish, they're not after control and efficiency. They're after resilience and robustness and flexibility. They want to survive to live another day, and they do that by being very responsive to their environment through this collective behavior.
You also cite the example of Best Buy. What's the Best Buy example?
Well, one of their executives attended a lecture by the author James Surowiecki, who wrote a book called Wisdom of Crowds, and the thesis of that book was that large groups, can be more intelligent than most of the people in the group, which seems counterintuitive. To test the idea out, the executive did a blast email to the staff at Best Buy during the Christmas season and said, I want everybody to send me their best guess for how many gift cards we're going to sell this holiday season. And when he tabulated all of the average of all the guesses in after the Christmas season, turned out to be 99% of what the actual correct answer was.
So they nailed
it. Which was 5% better than the professional group in Best Buy who were charged with making that decision.
Right.
Better than the experts, in other words. So he said, we're tapping into something here. Let's try something called a prediction market. Well, a prediction market is an even fancier way of tapping into collective intelligence. And you can access a number of prediction markets on the internet, you know, to predict things like, well, who's going to win the Academy Awards, or who's going to win the ball game, or who's going to win the next political election. And it turns out that when people treat information like a market and they put their virtual money, you know, against their opinion, then the group opinion can be extremely accurate.
Was there a connection to the animal kingdom in all of this? A conscious connection?
I don't believe that the prediction markets are directly linked to animal behavior, but what they're tapping into is the wisdom of the crowd. The wisdom of the crowd has direct analogies to, say, the wisdom of the hive or the wisdom of the ant colony. The principles that a beehive uses to make good decisions, and they have to make some critically good decisions, very important decisions, they're intriguingly similar to the same principles that we use as human groups to make decisions.
Let's go to our first phone call. Kathy calls now from Mount Gilead, North Carolina. Hi, Kathy.
Hey, how are you?
I'm great. How are you? Why don't you go ahead with your question?
I just have a comment. I heard about E.O. Wilson's book, Ant Hill, on your program, and have since read it and was just fascinated and wondered if your guest had studied him, had any contact with him, or anything like that.
Thanks. Thanks, Peter.
Well, thank you. Yes, I have met Dr. Wilson, and you may be familiar with the concept that he has recently written about called the superorganism, and he's writing about collective behavior in primarily social insects like ants. The idea is, and it's not necessarily a completely original idea with Dr. Wilson, but he brings it to full development with his colleague Bert Holdobler. The idea is that an ant colony is like an organism. It's like a body, and the ants are more like pieces of your fingernail or a heart muscle or skin. They only make sense when they put together into a body, and the body is the superorganism. So if you treat an ant colony, if you think about its motivations, about its behavior, it only makes sense when you think about the superorganism, which is made up of the individuals that belong to it.
Go to another call here, and King joins us from Alabama. Hi, King.
Yes, to your guest. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I'm wondering if your guest believes in a book called The Holy Bible.
Well, my book is about ants and bees and fish and termites and what they have to teach people. So there's plenty to look at in nature. Plenty of mysteries in their behavior to keep you busy, and lots of questions to be answered there.
You ask this a lot about creation versus evolution and what you're getting
well,
at.
Well, it's
here.
A natural question, of course. People look at nature and they see the intelligence at work there, but it's not really the focus of my book.
You talk about birds and the behavior of flocks. How does that differ from ants or bees, and what do we learn by studying flock behavior?
Well, the primary focus of my interest in flocks is the way that they share information with one another. If you look at a flock of birds in the sky, for example, starlings or sparrows in the fall, you see them swirling in these incredibly beautiful displays where they change and they go this way and they go that way, and you say, how can they do that without bumping into one another? And just like an ant colony or a beehive, there's no leader in a flock of birds. They're actually keeping track of one another, of their neighbors. So they're monitoring, you might say, five or six of their closest neighbors, and when their neighbors moves one way, they instantly respond. Schools of fish are the same way in the ocean. They pick up lots of information about what's out there by keeping close track of their neighbors. If there's a predator that approaches a school of fish, everybody in the school will know about it because the behavior ripples through the school very quickly. Same thing with, you know, like herds of caribou or wildebeest.
What do we learn from that?
Well, if you think about the what's different about a flock, the individuals in a flock are not related to one another usually. They have a motivation to be part of the flock, which is usually protection. We're like that. We're more like flocks and herds than we are like ants or bees, because we are, you might say, selfish herds. We are primarily interested in our own welfare, secondarily in, you know, our families, our company, our organizations. But we also take part in group behavior in which we're picking up information all the time from our coworkers. Or think about something like Facebook. Facebook is like being part of a big school of fish. You know, you're picking up all kinds of information from unexpected sources.
But the difference is that each individual in Facebook has his or her own identity, background, logic, personality, rationality. The fish don't.
Well, yeah, but if you're thinking about the behavior on fish on Facebook.
Facebook? You just named
right,
a new...
Right. The behavior on Facebook in which messages are disseminated to everybody in your network, and also in which you're picking up unexpected information that lets you know what's happening to all of your friends that you haven't heard from in a while. I don't think that necessarily we're tapping into all of our higher reasoning when that happens. I mean, it's more of a social thing.
I'm Frank Sesno, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, call us at 1-800-433-8850. Send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Back to the phones and Martha, who calls us from St. James, Missouri. Hi, Martha.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. My question is about ants. Do they immediately start their life as workers, or is there some element of childcare involved? And if so, how does that impact the community? I'll take my answer off the phone. Thank you.
Thanks, Martha.
Yes, there is a progression in the career, you might say, of an ant, and they are believed to change their work responsibilities from the time that they become young ants deep inside the nest. They then become nurse ants, and then they become maintenance ants, and they work their way up to becoming the ants that leave the nest and become the foragers. So essentially, what E.O. Wilson says is that the ant colony is sending out its old ladies to do the hard work outside the nest.
Yeah, the guys get a free pass in this world. I'm not sure that's a very marketable idea. Joseph from Gainesville, Virginia. Hi, Joseph.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I did want to comment something in support Mr. Miller's statements regarding how human collectives can go much farther than the individual. I'm an electrical engineer and engineering physicist that's had about 32 years of manufacturing background. And one of the most successful approaches I have ever seen to manufacturing is when every single individual from a project, in the commercial world, it would be marketing, design, quality, test, procurement, manufacturing, all of them were involved in the inception process from the very, very beginning. The most successful products with the greatest reliability, the most minimum warranty return process or service calls always resulted from this type of approach. As a matter of fact, it's something that this nation seems to have gotten away from in my period. And as a matter of fact, about 3 years ago, maybe four, the GAO had made a scathing report about the massive amounts of failures in government projects that were being funded on federal money, and that over two-thirds of all projects that were being funded from the military to intelligence were failing in the product delivery. And from my experience of what I've been seeing more of a tendency for an individual elitism to result in design processes that are only done by a few, not looked at by the collective, and then propagated into the manufacturing process. And it's almost guaranteed to be a cost overrun and or a disaster.
Interesting. Peter, comment on that.
Well, I think that's a fascinating comment, and I think there's a lot of interest in many businesses these days in tapping into the talents and opinions and problem-solving ability of all of the individuals in the group. What you're talking about essentially is recognizing the diversity of training and backgrounds and perspectives that exist in most organizations. And when you have a problem, whether it's designing a new product, the greater the diversity you can muster from your organization to apply to that, I think the better the decision-making will be. But the problem, as you point out, is that this goes against traditional hierarchical bureaucracies. Managers don't like to give up control, and frequently collective behavior looks like giving up control.
We're talking with Peter Miller, author of The Smart Swarm, How Understanding Flocks, Schools, and Colonies Can Make Us Better at Communicating, Decision-Making, and Getting Things Done. The Diane Rehm Show will continue.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
Think this summer is nasty? Imagine enduring the 1896 heat wave in New York City, in brick tenements with little air circulation or running water.
The temperatures inside would easily reach 120 degrees.
In 10 days, the heat killed nearly 1,500 people. We talk with Edward Cohn, author of Hot Time in the Old Town. Join us.
Hi, I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane Rehm today. Diane will be back with you tomorrow. Right now we're talking with Peter Miller. He's author of The Smart Swarm, How Understanding Flocks, Schools, and Colonies Can Make Us Better at Communicating, Decision-Making, and Getting Things Done. We're taking your calls and comments at 1-800-433-8850 and also at drshow@wamu.org if you want to email us. I want to go to a few of the emails now, Peter, because there's some interesting ones. Here's one from Doug, who writes, in a place as transient and socially mixed as contemporary America, what is my colony to defend and improve? Is it my ethnic group, religious group, neighborhood, business associates, fellow taxpayers, or just my family? I already feel like I'm being stung enough.
well, he put his finger on the issue of, you know, where's our commitment? Ant colonies and beehives don't have that problem because they're all genetically related and they are more invested in the outcome of the group genetically than they are even in themselves. They're willing to engage in risky behavior and sacrifice themselves because their real interest is in the group behavior. So the question is for us as individuals, how do we where is our allegiance? You know, what is our motivation?
What's our hive?
Exactly, right.
And so what's your answer to that?
Well, it depends. I mean, you can have all kinds of answers to that. If you're from the trivial to the very serious, I mean, if you're on a jury, then you need to be thinking about making the best decision possible using the resources of the people in the group. That's your group. If you belong to a church, maybe your congregation is the hive that you belong to.
Can you have more than one hive? Because
absolutely.
Does that happen in nature?
Absolutely.
The bees have more than one hive?
No, they don't. They don't, but we do, because we are the ultimate social creature. And as I mentioned before, we have the ability to join different groups for personal gain.
Lori writes to us, are there leaders for these hives? And if so, how do they determine who the leader should be?
That's easy. There are no leaders. The possible exception would be in a flock. If you really got down to it, one bird has to turn first. But that is not the same bird every time. They alternate positions within a flock. Same thing with a fish. You know, the fish in front is the one who's going to be seeing things and maybe pass the information along first, but it's never the same fish.
So when we look up and we see that wonderfully precise V of geese flying across the sky, there's not that same goose isn't up at the head of it.
If you watch them carefully, you'll see that they switch position.
George joins us now from Baltimore, Maryland. Hi, George.
Good morning. Good afternoon. I'm really enjoying the show, and I just need to put that out there first.
Great. Thank you.
You know, I'm one of them creationists, right? But I ultimately understand that this is all God's creation, and the process of evolution is part of that creation. And I had an experience with a bee, and that bee studied me while I had this can of wasp killer in my hand. He got in the low position. He hovered. And when he saw me pick up the can, when I looked at him, I started to pick the can up. And when I started to pick the can up, he got down low. It was interesting that these things are just like us, but we just don't trust. Thank you.
All right, thank you. What do you have to say to George, Peter?
Well, I think his last comment about trust is fascinating, because it turns out that individuals in groups in nature, of course, they do have to have trust. They have to trust their instincts, and they've evolved to behave collaboratively. Trust is important to us too. I mean, when we get involved in a committee or a jury or something, we have to have the more trust we have in the abilities of our coworkers, the more likely we are to have a good outcome.
It's a very interesting thing you just said about trusting in our instincts, because, you know, we're not bees, we're not ants most of the time, presumably. And you can find yourself having this conversation with yourself. Okay, my instincts would have me do this or suggest I do that, but my logic in my head takes me in another direction. Presumably that doesn't happen in the hive?
No, that doesn't happen in the hive, but it happens to me every morning when I decide to take the metro. What time to take the metro, whether I should drive, what road to take.
And your instincts tell you to stay at home.
My instincts tell me, right. My instincts tell me it's going to be bad, because I'm always afraid that, you know, everybody else will be making the same decisions
because
I am.
And you know it's an ant hive out there.
Exactly.
Jason from Salt Lake City is on the line. Hi, Jason.
Hi, thank you. I hope this isn't a repeat of the prior email, but I am curious to know, you know, if you were to drop a colony of ants into a new environment with no established difficulties to overcome or structures to, but how would the group actually start their work? Humans, obviously, leaders emerge, even in socialist societies or communist societies, where the idea is to have the group thought work for the community. But even in that structure in the human world, leaders emerge. How is it that with these animals, when we're watching their behavior, do we see that type of thing would happen where one person would start it? I guess my question is, what's the impetus or what's the seed in these organizations that starts the organization functioning as a singular organism?
Thanks, Jason. Peter.
Well, if you're talking about the life history of a colony, it begins with a single queen that leaves the nest on a flight where she is inseminated, and then she drops to the ground, drops her wings, and begins to dig a hole. She is the beginning of the new colony. And then when she gets the hole deep enough, she has eggs. She lays eggs, and the eggs become workers, and the workers become her hive, her nest. So it all begins with the single queen, but the queen, after laying the eggs, doesn't become the leader of the colony. The colony works as a group.
I have a very specific question from you here from Lenny, who emails the following. Is there anything we can gain from the study of colonies, swarms, flocks to address global warming? It seems to me that people act out of their own self-interest, he writes, and the interest of those in their immediate clan. Addressing global warming may require sacrifice from individuals for the betterment of all.
I think that's a brilliant question, and I've been thinking about that myself. Global warming seems like the kind of a problem where individual behavior could make a real difference. And in fact, I wrote an article about that for National Geographic. My wife and I went on a carbon diet for a month to see if we could reduce our carbon footprint. We did reduce our footprint quite a bit. It turns out also that the problem of global climate change is so big that it's going to probably take more than individual behavior. But it seems to me at this point in where we are in the climate change debate that the individual behavior is going to be the moving force, that people need to change their behavior first, and then leaders will follow.
What then is the connection to the hive or the mound?
Well, I think the question is, do your actions make any difference as an individual member of the planet Earth? If the Earth is our home and we're all members of the planet Earth, does it make any difference if we try and take care of it or not, or are we insignificant little insects?
Judy joins us from Jacksonville, Florida, with a call and a question. Hi, Judy.
Hi. My husband is a beekeeper, and I have great respect for these colonies and their success, their effectiveness. What I don't understand is how in human life the concept of collective became a negative concept. How did that happen?
Well, I'm not sure it has, in all contexts, become quite as negative as you may be suggesting. I think the problem is that when we try to organize to get things done, we tend to do it in a hierarchical way, and we don't think that every individual has something to contribute. We like to pigeonhole people and put them in different categories, little tasks, and then feeding, the organization.
But is that universal, Peter, or is that cultural? I mean, we talk about communitarian societies. We talk about places where, it takes a village. You write that in this country, as someone rather famous did, and it can be very controversial. The United States of America was established around the concept of individual freedoms, an abundance of space and opportunity and all that, and that you would not be burdened by the administrative or the authoritarian role of the collective or the leader.
Yes.
And it's a very different culture here and concept than go to China, go
yes,
to Japan,
absolutely.
Go to Europe.
No, you're quite right. In terms of on the cultural spectrum, the United States is the most probably individualistic-oriented
right.
society.
We don't want to live
right.
in beehives.
And I've had some very interesting conversations with people about more traditional cultures, Native American cultures, where consensus is reached in a collective way, in a group setting.
You say collective on the street, it sounds like a communist collective, and that's very much got a negative connotation, as the caller pointed out.
Yes. If in terms of political organization, if you collectivist doesn't have a very good ring to it. But if you say collaborating or group or doing your part for the team, then I think people understand that we all have something to contribute to the organization that we're dedicated to.
How much of this then is cultural?
Well, I think there is a difference between in societies such as Chinese societies or Japanese societies, where people are more oriented toward feeling like they're part of the group than they are trying to establish their own individuality. But I still think that we are human beings. And we have our own habits and limitations, and that in the end, we will rely upon our own judgment and reasoning rather than being instinctively oriented toward group behavior.
Peter Miller is author of The Smart Swarm, How Understanding Flocks, Schools, and Colonies Can Make Us Better at Communicating, Decision-Making, and Getting Things Done. I'm Frank Sesno. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join us in the remaining minutes of the program, you can do so at 1-800-433-8850 or email us at drshow@wamu.org. Thomas joins us now by phone from the Florida Keys, I understand, Thomas. I hope the Florida Keys are as wonderful as they sound. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you. It's very beautiful here. I'm curious if you've applied your theories to prison populations, and if so, if you studied them, what have you learned?
No, I have to say I haven't looked at that, but I'd be curious why you asked the question.
We lost Peter there, so I think he was interested about the psychology. My understanding is he's a psychology student, mm-hmm. and obviously looking at you've got a very restrictive beehive there, mm-hmm. and whether those behaviors, where presumably there's a corrective component to that, can be adjusted, and if you can learn anything through the hives and the mounds and the anthills.
Well, it seems, you know, on the surface of it, that you're controlling the behavior of inmates very rigidly, and that would seem to be counterproductive to the kind of group intelligence that we're talking about.
We have a caller from the great state of Texas. Alex joins us on the phone. Hi, Alex.
Hi, yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just wanted to make a comment that all humans have this innate hubris that as humans they're vastly superior to all sorts of other animals on this planet. But I just wanted to comment that in reality, many of the very basic social tools that other animals possess are just merely, our social interactions are merely more evolved forms of those.
Peter, you agree with that? Is that what you find in your research as you look at flocks and swarms?
Well, I think what the caller is recognizing is that when we're trying to choose a restaurant and we go down the street and we see there's a long line at one and no line at the other, we're going to probably get in line to go to the restaurant.
No, not me. I don't want to wait. What I do is I say, oh, that must be a good restaurant. I'll come back sometime when there's not a line.
In other words, we're picking up information using our instincts, using our natural tendency to follow one another unless we're guaranteed in getting an advantage by not following.
Let me throw a couple of words at you, Peter Miller, that I don't see necessarily in the individuals, in the hives, in the swarms, in the flocks, but we certainly see and celebrate in individuals, in humanity, innovation, invention, creativity. That is an individual enterprise built on the shoulders of knowledge over time, obviously, which may come from the group. But it's a very individual kind of thing in human experience that doesn't exist, unless I'm thinking of it all wrong, on an individual basis in these hives and flocks.
No, I think you're right. If you're talking about the ongoing progression of our culture and knowledge, that sets us apart from a lot of the natural groups. But if you look at, again, if you look at how different, what is different about an ant colony, there's a lot of randomness, a lot of experimentation taking part. The ants are not doing what's predictable all the time, and that's part of one of their secrets.
Are they creative in what they're doing, these ants that build the same anthill in so many different places?
I wouldn't call them creative. I would call them adaptive.
Okay. We have just about 90 seconds remaining to the program, Peter. I want to ask you, in all your work and study for this book, what would you say, what did you come away with as your sort of bottom line of what you've learned from these behaviors that you think we can best or most urgently apply to the way we do our jobs, live our lives as human beings?
I think it has to do with making better decisions individually and also as groups, that we don't, that we tend to make decisions out of improper habits or logic, and that really, if we have an important decision for our organization, we need to tap into all kinds of different points of view, and we need to be open to other solutions. And we're more likely to get a good decision from a group than we are from a overstressed single person making decisions for everybody.
And if you could be an ant, a bee, a bird, or a fish...
I love the honeybees. I just love the way that they combine working together and working apart.
Peter Miller, he's author of The Smart Swarm, How Understanding Flocks, Schools, and Colonies Can Make Us Better at Communicating, Decision-Making, and Getting Things Done. So as I move into my new house, I'm going to watch that anthill really closely to see where I should move the furniture or where I should open the window. Thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. I'm Frank Sesno. You've been listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Have a great day.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.